I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today on the Inland Journal podcast, our final conversation with David Condon while he serves as mayor of Spokane. Condon is leaving office after 8 years. He was the first person to be reelected mayor in quite a while. He leaves the city in good financial shape with an economy that continues to grow. The city has taken on and nearly finished a huge public works project designed to improve the quality of the Spokane River. Riverfront Park is in the last stages of an expensive remodel. The University District is growing with a bright future. The West Plains is experiencing a huge build-out, and a new public development authority is in the works for economically challenged areas in northeast Spokane. On the other hand, there are issues with homelessness that many other American cities are grappling with, and a housing shortage that could continue to drive up prices. With all of that as context, we meet Condon for our final bi-monthly interview. Outside his office on an easel is a display that outlines the 100-day transition to the new mayor-elect. We start by asking how that transition is going.
We've been preparing for this, in essence for 4 years. And in earnest, really since June to August timeframe, and then that's when we released the 100-day plan. It starts becoming more real, absolutely. But also, as we had worked on transitioning these things now for several months, and now it's getting to that point. Someone mentioned I have been talking a lot about the 100-day transition plan, and I spent 9 years in the Army. I didn't think about it until someone commented that maybe you're used to it because of your military time. We watch it here locally that the commander of Fairchild switches out every 2 years. And so I lived through that for 9 years where you have commanders come and go, and it's just part of the process. And maybe in part, I'm more comfortable with it that way. And I also, am ready for the next chapter in my life with my family. Some of it's relief. I think I'll feel it ultimately on January 1st at 12:01, because a city government is in a city is a living organism, and things don't stop. The 12:01, the 911 phones still ring, and the garbage needs to be picked up, and streetlights need to work, and God forbid the snow still falls.
But if somebody else is getting the calls in the middle of the night.
Exactly.
So are you talking publicly about what you're going to do after you become mayor, or is that still up in the air for you?
It's still up in the air. We want to stay in Spokane. I wasn't mayor for 8 years to leave. I will be going back as a private citizen and work not in elected office, whether that be in government or whether that be in the private sector. That's still to be determined. I'll be focusing on that now. I'm not retiring. I didn't take the city retirement quite purposefully. I'll be working.
So the transition period, the 100 days, what are some of the highlights of that?
Absolutely. So we started back in September, 100 days out, and it was finalizing the program budget, and then the capital budget, and then ultimately the divisional budget, which was delivered on November 1st. So that was a highlight. And then the budget process as we do that. We also have scheduled since those preparations, we also have scheduled for the new administration starting as quick as Friday morning. We do our quarterly performance measures, and we've invited the mayor-elect to come and see the nuts and bolts of the city. We've also scheduled time for ride-alongs with frontline staff. We've also scheduled time to meet with senior officials, the appointed officials, and also to, in earnest, fill the 20-plus positions that are vacant or filled with interims right now.
So you've been a supporter of Ms. Woodward for a while, mm-hmm. and tell me why you think she's going to be a good mayor.
The job of mayor more and more is the ability to communicate and to engage the public. I think that is such a critical skill that you can't hire to. No one wants the mayor to be represented by somebody else at a community event, at a town hall meeting. You don't outsource that, or you don't ask somebody else to do it, or when time to time when the scheduling requires us to do that, people aren't real excited when they don't get the mayor. And so I think that's such a critical skill to have. Over the last 8 years, I've honed that skill. I don't think I came into the job with that level of a skill. And so I am encouraged to see how she brings that to the table. And, you know, and local government is designed on purpose, and I can't, you know, think that there's a better way than it's to be run by citizens. You know, if something is only to be run at this magnitude of somebody that has 30 years in it, and, you know, cities shouldn't run like a corporation. Now there's, it's functionally a corporation, I guess. But you know, it doesn't, you know, if there, you know, it's not to, increase profits, you know, it's not, you know, it's not to, even as we act as a very large insurance company, you know, one of our biggest lines of business is because we're self-insured at any given time, we're operating as a major insurance company. And when you settle those cases, it's with your own citizens, but at the same time, it's, you're also have the purse strings of your own citizens, but you have to do it in a unique way. It's not the same, premise as other, and that's one thing that brought me into office was settling, with Otto's family. And yes, we still have to act and make sure that we're fiscally prudent, but on the other hand, make somebody whole. And so to me, you know, that kind of perspective, or in the case of one of the other reasons why I was elected was utility rates. And of course, you could increase utility rates and maximize the income to the city, but you also have to see what the impact is on your owners, and your owners are your customers. And so, yes, we need to have world-class infrastructure. And as you look across the country where, unfortunately, you know, cities are literally crumbling, that's not what you see around here. You see the infrastructure investment, it has never been more in decades. Well, it fundamentally hasn't been more in real dollars or otherwise. And so you also need the revenue streams to make that happen.
So I'm interested that you've said this, that because I hear a lot of political candidates say government should be run like a business. And you, who has a pro-business sort of perspective, are taking that, that's not quite right.
You should utilize business practices, absolutely. But as soon as you start going down the path of maximizing profits for your shareholders, your owners, or otherwise. Now, I also believe in the free market, that you have to do that in an area that's competitive and brings value, perceived or otherwise, to your customers. But also, you need to run a city in the sense of your owners are actually your citizens, and so your value proposition needs to be very succinct and very plausible for that investment. We've had a major initiative in this organization to really be connected to our citizens much more. And so, you know, when I got here, we used to send out a brochure that had 80 plus phone numbers. We now have a single phone number. We track on how good's our response. And if we aren't doing a good job, we got to, you know, fix that. And then just here a couple months ago, besides the 311 and the single customer service counter inside City Hall, we now have the My Spokane 311 app, where people literally can drop a pin on a map and it reports a pothole, and they will get an email after we fill it. You know, so it's not only a phone call. You can do it as you're driving down the street, take a picture of it, send it to us, and it GIS maps it, and we know where it is, and it gets immediately sent to our pothole crew, and now we can track how long it took us. And if we aren't doing a good job, you know, we need to hold ourselves accountable. And I, you know, as people start seeing that get in place and see the effectiveness of it, or if a swing is broken at a park, you can take a picture of it and send it to us, and through the My Spokane app, and that'll become a work order for one of our great frontline staff to go fix it. And so when the babysitter does that and realizes 3 days later they go back or whatever it is and it's fixed, they're pleased. Or if it's not, they're sending us another one saying, why isn't it done? And so, you know, so those sorts of business practices, absolutely. But I would, and you nailed it. People say it all the time. And maybe I'm taking a more nuanced, you know, approach to it, but it's not carte blanche. And that's why sometimes you see very successful CEOs and executives that have done a very good job at bringing value to their customers and to their owners not do well in government. And I would say, as you know, We really focused on leaderships that's transformative rather than transactional. One of the Achilles heel on transformative leadership and kind of implementing a team that way is that often it's going against the grain, and some of that grain is your own citizens. And so you need that engagement if you want the transformative things. And as you look at the One Spokane Strategic Plan, we really focused on projects, and they're still there and they're still ongoing, that were by nature controversial, but because they're transformative. And anytime you're transformative, the incumbent businesses, citizens aren't always happy about it. And so you really have to communicate. And I think that's what's exciting with Ms. Woodward and what she'll be able to bring to the table, that as you do these transformative things, that are you able to communicate? And, you know, probably one of the greatest compliments I get is, you know, Mayor, I didn't vote for you. I haven't agreed with every decision you've made, but I'm sure glad you were our mayor the last 8 years. You know, I could also say I enjoy the compliments of, I did vote for you, I agreed with everything you did, and I wish you could still be our mayor. But I also, I take a lot of gratitude in listening to someone that doesn't see the world the same way I do, that didn't vote for me, but didn't feel ostracized by the decisions I made, or felt like I explained my decisions enough, even if they didn't agree with what the outcome was.
We're talking with outgoing Spokane Mayor David Condon on the Inland Journal podcast.
So another of the mayor's constituencies is city council, and you had to deal with a council often that was aligned against you just in terms of their philosophical views versus yours, and they had they could override your vetoes. The new mayor may step into that same sort of situation. How do you counsel her to deal with a city council that may be not philosophically inclined with you all the time?
Well, I think there's a couple strategies. One is to go back to the One Spokane Strategic Plan. We developed that together. We stated a vision that we had together. The committee meetings that the council now has is based off of that strategy. The value statements are agreed on. And then debate the hell out of the way you get there. And then ultimately, you're going to have to communicate, and you know, and there's different ways to influence the vote. One is one-on-one discussions with the other elected officials. Others is to use our partners in the media to explain your position, in the hopes that that also then can convince other elected officials. The other is to appoint senior officials that can communicate well with the city council, and that's why I didn't use a political philosophy yardstick on who I appointed to many of these positions. So philosophically, some of my senior officials probably more align with the city council, but then come to a point of being able to explain why the decisions that we're making. And then ultimately, you need to go with what you believe the citizens have, and I've done that many times. And probably, you know, in some cases, if I was more transactional, would have been able to get other things done, but it's not a spot where I went. And in some cases, perhaps could have gotten other things done if I did.
So much of politics has become personal these days, as we've become so polarized. Have you been able to keep from feeling it personally when things were going against you in this office?
Oh, you never do. And I think that's, you know, people ask, what will you miss? The impact of the negative chatter on my family is real. When you're 6-year-old or then 4 or 5 and 7-year-old, they see it physically, whether somebody's, you know, angry at you or, you know, that sort of thing. They feel it. They also feel it and see it in me. I would also suggest, though, that this isn't a new phenomenon, you know, and even people talk about this election cycle. You know, I'll be honest, look at the stuff that was used against me, you know, and the websites that were developed and and so I take some umbrage that this is a new phenomenon. I don't think it is. I think especially when you lead a city, I think your style matters. More and more in today's world, people look to elected leaders as the compass for a community, and very broadly speaking, and I think style matters. And so I think those can be, you know, one of my points that I ran on was it was a matter of leadership. And of course, I came in with a very strong, you know, leadership style. That works for some and not for others. I think you'd be hard pressed for most to not know who the mayor was of the last 8 years or the decisions we made. And you see those coming through. And it has its strengths and it has its weaknesses in that style. And that's why I believe in coming in and leaving, public life. And there'll be a whole new group of engaged people. There'll be some that are the same, but then also a whole new group. And I think that's key for a city's health.
So let's finish with this. As you leave office, what are the types of things that excite you the most in terms of, I'd really love to be involved in that, or, I could see myself doing that for the next 5 years or something like that?
I get really excited about where this community is going. I'll start first with I'll be excited every time they open another middle school and seeing how we transformed the education system here. That, when we talk about building the city of choice, ask any realtor, the number one reason someone buys their house is what school their kid's going to get to go to. And after a couple decades of our school system shrinking in size, which really means that families aren't choosing to live here, to be growing and to see the choices that are offered by Spokane Public Schools, it was my team that sat down side by side with the school district to come together with that plan, and I was very intimately involved in it. And this week we'll be signing final documents on transfers of land. The other is really the future of, one of our strategic goals is to be the fastest growing job market. And what's exciting to me is that the three industries that I really think are so critical are who we have been foundationally. So we've been a healthcare hub for years, but healthcare is more than health. It is life sciences, and to see two medical schools, two nursing schools, a pharmacy school, to see the impact on rural parts of Eastern Washington, to see that amount of investment in this community, I get excited, both for our citizens and living, healthier lives because of that. But then also, quite frankly, the economic development around it and the job creation. The second one is in the area of energy. We've led the country for, several decades in carbon free energy production, whether that be in hydropower and other opportunities, but really seeing where we're going in that area. And we've led for generations, but then also going forward in those industries, and how do we deliver that in a reliable, safe, smart way, whether it be Itron, Schweitzer Engineering, Apana, all of these that are brought because of the innovation. And then in ag and forestry, what we're doing, if you couldn't see something in this world about that's more critical than food production in a way that's more sustainable, in a way that's more economical, in a way that's more cognizant of those that work in the ag industry, or you see the forestry industry now and what's happening with cross-laminated timber and what we're doing here in Spokane in that spot. And really, but these are all based on generational, whether it be resources and ag and forestry, or whether it be energy, or whether it be life sciences. These aren't new, but the where we're going on the innovation in these areas is not only leading the country, but in many respects is leading the world. Wait till you see what's happening, or when we're invited to Copenhagen to see, and they're more interested in us and what we're doing in food sciences and food production and all of these things in a healthy way and in a way that's less impact on the environment. And so that's what's exciting. Often cities, chase the newest thing. And yes, you need to stay on the forefront, but that newest thing should have a foundation in what you're doing and what your knowledge base is. And we have that here. And so that's cool to see where those companies are going and as a region we're going.
David Condon is the outgoing mayor of Spokane. He'll make way for the new mayor-elect on December 30th. Tonight, KSPS Public Television airs a new documentary called Capturing History. It's about three early 20th century photographers whose pictures tell us a lot about our collective history in Spokane and in the Okanagan Valley. We talked with the documentary's producer, Mary DeCesare, its executive producer, Jim Zimmer, and the narrator, photographer Don Hamilton.
It's about three very different photographers, turn of the 20th century photographers. The first one is Charles Libby, and really when we think of that time period, we're looking through the lens of these photographers to tell the story. So when you think back to early Spokane, most likely you're thinking of a Libby photograph.
No other Spokane photographer took as many pictures over as long of a period as Charles Libby. By the time he retired in 1962, Libby had worked for over six decades. He photographed four presidents and left more than 200,000 negatives. For Libby, the early 1900s was a very exciting time to be a photographer. New technologies like halftones allowed photographers to publish their work in books, newspapers, and advertisements. This created a new demand for commercial photography, a form that Libby would wholeheartedly embrace.
When people ask you what you're working on right now, and you say, Charles Libby, and they kind of look at you with a blank stare, and then you say, you know what, if you've seen a photograph of Spokane, you know, in the last century, you probably know the guy. So you go into any pub, tavern, you know, restaurant, anything that has older Spokane in it, and it's most likely a Libby print, and that's when people kind of go, oh, you know, okay, now I know who you're talking about. And so, you know, his body of work is just so important to our history. You know, it's our history that he's managed to document.
I'm in the presence of Libby's actual camera equipment here at the Mac, under the watchful eyes of the curator. I can't believe my great good fortune to be able to lay my hands on Libby's actual machines. Believe it or not, Libby's photography equipment was considered field gear. It was lighter than most of the studio cameras, but it was still a lot of heavy equipment to haul around. For example, in the beginning, Libby shot on individual glass plates like this one.
They were heavy, very, very heavy. So early on in photography, you don't get a lot of images because you're lugging around 12 glass plates. That's actually quite a bit of weight. And glass plates are shot in the size that the print is going to be. So if you wanted to take an 8x10 photograph, you would shoot with an 8x10 glass plate.
And then Frank Matsura, he was a Japanese immigrant, a very interesting story. He moved to the Okanagan Valley area, and it was really more of a Wild West kind of feel. But he befriended the people there, and his pictures are more like a family member might take.
Matsura would have fit right into our culture today of Instagrams and selfies. He took photographs like a family member would, with a real personal connection, many times including himself. Frank Matsura was well-liked in the Okanagan Valley. He was gregarious, full of fun, and seemed to get along with everyone from all walks of life. His camera knew no social barriers. Cowboys, farmers, miners, Native Americans, women, rich or poor, they all came under his spell.
The technology at the time involved, you know, big cameras with bellows and heavy tripod, and for each photograph you had to pull open the back, stick in a film holder, pull out the dark slide, make an exposure. It is not the same thing as it is for all of us today with our phones in our pockets, our magic cameras in our pockets, but his photography had a spontaneity to it that might be more at home today with your iPhone than what you would expect from a man having to use all that cumbersome technology. But, you know, Matsura was just amazing.
I want to make sure we give a shout out to the folks, especially up in the Okanagan. The County Historical Society are volunteers. And that's the Matsura images were pretty amazing because they were divided after his death. And a large number of them were in a garage for 40 years, and then they were rediscovered, and the local newspaper editor actually took upon himself to print from these negatives, and they kind of discovered what they had there. And then all these volunteers became very active in sorting this out, identifying them, and then learning more about Matsura, combing the newspaper archives and finding all this information out about him. So they've discovered a history that they didn't know they had. And then thanks to their work, they've been able to share that with us, and now we're going to share it with the audience. So the Okanagan area, I think, will be really excited to see some images that they probably haven't seen before of their early life.
And then Frank Palmer, who really loved nature, he took beautiful pictures for the Chamber of Commerce, which he hand-painted, and they're just very gorgeous.
Our final photographer is Frank Palmer, who lived in Spokane in the early 1900s. Palmer called himself a scenic photographer who photographed nature's grandest scenes. His beautiful hand-painted photographs were used to attract tourists to eastern Washington and northern Idaho. Palmer's images included grand waterfalls, pristine lakes, and towering mountains. They capture the essence and spirit of turn-of-the-century Washington and Idaho.
With Libby, we had an incredible amount of images, thanks to the collection at the MAC. But unbelievably, there were very few of Libby himself, you know, that old on the cobbler's kid, no shoes. And with him, he was behind the camera. Ironically, Libby's personality was harder to discover than Frank Matsura, because so much of his personality was in his work. And a small town newspaper in Okanagan area documented his activities. Frank Matsura visited so-and-so's ranch this week. Frank Matsura did that and did that. Nobody was chronicling Libby's work, but Matsura was almost a celebrity up there, you know, and his personality was so big that we really know probably more about Matsura's life than we do about Libby's in his interactions with things. And then Frank Palmer, you know, we know less of him. He worked here for a shorter period of time.
Capturing history and the time machine that these images represent, the thing is that technically back in the day, 8x10 photography was the standard. You sort of had to do it. There was no other choice. Nobody had a Nikon. Nobody had an iPhone. But the depth, the detail that is in each one of these photographs is staggering. So we have this window to the past, and you can just fall into it.
We heard from the executive producer of Capturing History, Jim Zimmer, along with its producer, Mary DeCesare, and the narrator, photographer Don Hamilton. KSPS will air Capturing History tonight at 7. If you're not able to see it or record it then, you can stream it at the KSPS website. Inland Journal covers local public affairs and other things that interest us. You can subscribe to the podcast at Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or Google Play, or hear it at the Spokane Public Radio website. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.